Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Julia LaRose Show. We have a returning guest, a friend of the show. We are joined today by Chris Whalen. He is an investment banker and chairman of Whalen Global Advisors. He is also the author of The Institutional Risk Analyst. In this episode, we discuss Chris's new piece on the death of leverage and how higher rates are impacting investor behavior, particularly their allocation preferences and how they are seeking more value and more income and moving away from some of those speculative investments. We also got Chris's take on the economy, the bifurcation that he's seen between consumers and the commercial side of things. We also delved into his thesis on the silent crisis that's taking place in commercial. I really enjoyed this conversation with Chris. I always learn something from him, and I know you will too. Chris Whalen, chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, author of The Institutional Risk Analyst and an investment banker, and also an author of multiple books. It is great to see you again, Chris, and great to welcome you back on the show. I love having you on, and I know the audience does too, so I really appreciate you taking the time.
Hey, my pleasure. It's a quiet week.
Yeah, quiet week, I suppose. Well, I feel like you're becoming a friend of the show, and I'm looking forward to getting you on more often. And it's been about 3 months since we last had you. We just had the big banks report. I know we have some smaller regional banks continue to report. But I want to just start again where I always start with the guest, and that is to get their big picture, macro view, where we are in the economy. We can throw markets in there. And one of the things about this show, as a reminder, is you can take all the time you need to set the table when it comes to that macro picture.
Sure, Julia. Well, thank you for having me. I think what I would tell you is that, you know, we're in a weird kind of dichotomy. On the one hand, the consumer is doing okay. The default rates in consumer mortgages, for example, are very low. Even construction loans from banks for single family homes are doing great. Almost no defaults. But then you change the focus to the commercial side. Buildings for offices and malls and all sorts of other asset classes aside from commercial real estate, and they're suffering because of high interest rates. Excuse me. A lot of stuff that was financed in 2019 and 20 and 21 cannot be financed today. And you have private equity firms that are levering up their portfolios because they can't do an IPO for the company. So there's a lot of illiquidity in this system on the commercial side. Consumer, I think, is a problem next year, but probably not this year. And, you know, earnings kind of reflects this, too. So it's an interesting time. I think, you know, it's very important watching what happened at Tesla with earnings. They are trying to manage down the deflation of the EV bubble. I don't know what we're going to do about this. It's just a vast misallocation of capital, isn't it, Julia? I mean, my God.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it's a fascinating picture you paint. Like, we're in this dichotomy. The consumer side seems to be doing fine, though maybe that might not be the case next year.
Low-income consumers are getting kicked around.
They're bifurcated as well.
Oh, absolutely. Think of the group that really had a tough time during COVID, didn't have savings, lost their jobs, had to go on forbearance for their mortgage or their rent. And emerged from a couple of years of that damaged, maybe lost a business or lost, you know, a job they had had pre-COVID. So the impact of that is still playing out. And then we had to go fight inflation as soon as we were done. So, you know, we've reset rates back to kind of when Alan Greenspan started off as Fed chairman. Think of that. And that is a remarkable turnabout. I also think it's permanent. You know, we're entering a period where there's not as much savings as there was 20 years ago. And for all these governments out there that are running fiscal deficits, I think the competition for that money is going to intensify, and you're going to see higher interest rates. You know, we're facing what Bob Duggar, the retired chairman at Tudor, says, a drought of savings. And he's absolutely right. It follows demographics. So I think that's kind of the medium term. If you want to set the table.
The medium term. So rates remaining at a higher level, I want to flesh that out and the implications there, what that could mean let's hear more of your outlook as it relates to the rates.
Well, I think the Fed, if they wanted to tomorrow, could cut short-term rates. I'm not sure that the long end of the curve would follow them. The 10-year Treasury note is pretty expensive. If you look at the yield curve at 4.5, 4.6%, it's the lowest thing out there. So I think if anything, you're going to see the curve normalize, flatten out. Even if they drop the short end eventually, let's say they give us a rate cut at the end of the year and maybe two, and we get Fed funds down to 5. Now, 5 is better than 5.5 for dealers and everybody else who have to finance production in that short-term market. But I'm not sure how much relief we're going to get for long-term investors who have to go out and issue bonds to finance a company or to do anything that's long-term in nature. So I think that's the difference here. In the past, as soon as the Fed dropped short-term rates, the whole yield curve followed. And that's what I think may change as we go forward, Julia.
What does that signal if the long end of the curve, if it remains high, like does that signal like a loss of faith or trust in the is there a signal that it sends when it doesn't come down?
It's mixed because there's a lot of components in there. There's demand for the dollar. There's financing demand in dollars offshore, which is huge. I mean, the Chinese are short dollars. That's how they finance their economy. There are a lot of other countries out there that are effectively forced to index themselves to dollars. So there's always demand if you think of it as a means of exchange and a unit of account. But investors may want a higher yield. You know, look at what happened in the Middle East when the Iranians and the Israelis started lobbing missiles at each other. Yields went up. When was the last time we saw that, Julia? So I think that the preference of investors for treasuries is not changing, but they may demand higher returns simply because of the risk. You know, and if Congress doesn't get their act together, they're going to force Moody's to finally downgrade the United States and align with S&P. At AA+, I think that would be a disaster because, you know, we always use the lowest rating in credit. That's just the normal way that these things are done. But, you know, if Moody's was to follow suit, I think that would be a big deal.
Mm-hmm. And is that's in reference to like our like fiscal picture
long-term,
here, the incredible
debt rating. That's
yeah. Right. Well, okay. I do want to get your take there because I know last time you and I spoke at the beginning of the year, we had already crossed $34 trillion in debt.
Oh, yeah.
Last time I checked, I think it was like $34.6 trillion. It is just surging higher.
Well, I'm redoing my first book, Inflated. We have to rewrite the end.
share more of the thesis in Inflated. And I know that book, what was that, came out like a decade ago, but now you have a new one. Can you just share, that was one of those like seminal works.
Well, it was written in a crazy time, 2010. You know, we were still all broke. If you think about it, for really 3 years after the great financial crisis, there was no liquidity in a lot of markets that you and I have been following forever, right? So, you know, by 2012-13, things started to come back together, but we still had a whole decade where there was very little credit creation, virtually no credit creation on the housing side. So it's funny how these things come and go in cycles, the 1990s, the 2010s. In both cases, you had very flat markets. So I think now, you know, what people are struggling with is that they can't use leverage to, you know, essentially propel growth. Leverage costs money now. If I'm a dealer and I'm out there trading existing, say, municipal bonds, right? Most of those bonds have 4% and 5% coupons, but I'm paying 7% for short-term money to finance my book. That's not going to work. So our whole financial complex is struggling with how to deal with higher rates, both short-term and long-term, when the vast body of assets out there have coupons that reflect much lower rates and have much lower prices as a result. You know, a Fannie Mae 3.5, which was originated, say, in 2021, is trading at 90 cents on the dollar today, Julia. So we're going to have to start thinking about interest rates in terms of mark-to-market losses for banks again. Remember last October? We were at 5. Well, we're going back to 5 on the 10-year. That's your benchmark for pain when it comes to mark-to-market losses. At the end of the piece we posted today, we did, you know, the basic calculation on Bank of America. What's their coupon for all of their assets, right? Well, it turns out it's more than a point below the rest of the big banks. That's not a good place to be, because if rates go up further, the pain these institutions are going to face is that either you sell the asset at a loss and redeploy the proceeds in a higher yielding asset, right, which is going to crater your earnings this quarter, or you sit and you just sit underwater and you take the pain over time. That, I think, is going to really intensify. If we get the 10-year up into the fives, which I think is possible, you're going to see a lot of pain on Wall Street.
Yeah. Talk to me about the piece you put out, The Death of Leverage. I saw it go up just before you came on here, so I didn't get to, I didn't get to read the whole thing. So
that's a quiet week. We can do thoughtful pieces. So I'm getting ready to rebalance our bank index. And yes, I am working on two ETFs, so we'll talk more about that later in the year. But, you know, it's a funny time. In a way, it's going to be good for banks because you're going to have higher yields on assets. But the winners are going to be the people who manage their book really short, keep the duration really under control, Julia, and are able to take advantage of higher price assets because they're not losing money. You know, I'll give you an example. During COVID, Brian Moynihan could have sold all of those 2% mortgages he originated for a, you know, 104. He could have put that money in the T-bills, and he didn't do that. So today he's sitting with a book that, you know, yields, his mortgage book yields 2.5%. His cost of funds is over 4. So you know what I mean? That's the mismatches that we're seeing in the financial world now. And my God, you know, when you have real interest rates, what happens to all of the aspirational asset classes like private equity? Well, they can't do IPOs. And so that's a huge problem for pension funds and private equity, you know, sovereign wealth funds and everybody else who jumped into commercial real estate, jumped into these other asset classes, thinking that they were a haven. And now it's turned out that they're moribund. They can't be liquefied. So they're borrowing against the assets. I don't think that's a long-term solution. So we have a lot of illiquidity we have to deal with. There will be opportunities here for the restructuring profession. But I think you're going to see a lot of losses to, you know, people who bought assets that were not necessarily liquid or have changed their liquidity profile over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. So there's a liquidity problem there. Does that spill over into the consumer side, or does that affect the broader economy?
It will affect confidence. You know, look at New York Community Bank. When they mishandled their disclosure, it affected confidence and it affected the value of the stock. So to the extent you have situations where people are surprised by an event that comes out of a company or an industry sector, that's going to affect their confidence. You know, so far there's so much liquidity in the system that the consumer hasn't even blinked. And it's not to say they're not working hard, and it's not to say that they're not suffering from the effects of inflation. They are, very, very clearly. But at the same time, Americans don't give up. They're out there trying to get it done. And I think that's why employment's been so strong. And that's why the Fed is having such a tough time declaring victory over inflation. Now, one thing we mentioned in my blog today, which I think you're going to really like, is this. You know, the Fed decided that price stability was 2%. Okay, so they now have a 2% inflation target. But if you follow real estate the way I do, especially commercial real estate, it kind of makes sense, because if you had zero inflation, or if you actually had a deflation, which you have now in office properties, well, that's bad, because the math that goes along with that, when prices are falling, when the rent roll of a building is falling because they had to make concessions to tenants, right? Well, what happens to the value of the building? It goes down. We're having this fight in New York right now over rent-stabilized apartment buildings in New York City. The left, you know, the Democrats, thinks that inflation is not a problem. Therefore, they can tell landlords that you don't get reimbursed if you fix up an apartment. What are the landlords going to do? They're going to lock the apartment. They're going to take it off the market. So, you know, this progressive effort to, quote unquote, help consumers actually results in fewer rent-stabilized apartments being on the market. Because they, you know, if you're a landlord, you can't rent that apartment if it's not up to code. when you have a tenant leave, you have to bring it up, a long-term tenant especially, right? You have to bring it up to code. And the, you know, the Democrats in New York think that they can tell landlords that you can't recover your costs if you renovated a rent-stabilized apartment. Well, fine. We just won't show it. So that's the kind of weird politics you have in some of these states, California as well. Oregon is another state where they've gone down the rent control bunny hole. But, you know, at the end of the day, it costs what it costs to run the building. That's it. New York City is the most expensive city in the United States. It costs almost $2,000 a square foot to build a new apartment. Think about that.
$2,000 a square foot.
Wow. I could build you a beautiful house up here in Westchester, which is an expensive market, for $300 a square foot. So now you know why we moved.
Yeah.
The economics don't work. You know, I can't make New York City affordable. There's no way I could do that. It would have to be subsidized, and it is. Mm-hmm. They're stealing money from the property owners now. But you know what happened? All of those developers, they went down to Florida. They're not going to come back. They're down in Texas and the Carolinas building new properties. So yeah. That's kind of the state of things in commercial right now, Julia. It's not all bad. I'll tell you a really funny story because I know you have more questions. I went to Villanova. So I'm listening to the radio the other day, and turns out King of Prussia Mall, which is west of Philadelphia, right? Fully let, doing great. And you would think, well, aren't all the malls going out of business? No, some of them work very well if they have a good, role in the community. If people use the property, it does great. I thought that was such a funny story. It's an affluent suburb of Philadelphia, but mm-hmm. still.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, like, I've been going to the malls lately and they are just like packed. And I remember like, probably like 10 years ago, it was like the death of the mall. I don't know. Maybe there's like a resurgence.
Well, I'm taking my wife to Westchester Mall this weekend. We're going on a exploratory journey. She's never been there. She's just a nice Dutch girl who's learning to live in the suburbs.
Nice. I love that. Okay. So the last couple times you and I've talked on the commercial side, we were talking about like the silent crisis. Where are we in that thesis today?
Oh, it's evolving. Commercial real estate moves like glaciers. It moves very, very slowly. So if the property gets into trouble, if they can't sell it, for example, the bank will extend the loan on similar terms. They still want more money up front, because obviously the value of the asset has gone down. But people tend to slow walk these situations, Julie, because they're very political. When you're talking about an apartment building in New York City, that's the most political thing you can touch. Because if it goes into foreclosure, the city is going to be standing right there looking at the bank saying, oh, you got to take care of the building. And this is what happened with the Signature Bank assets. Marty Gruenberg at the FDIC has had to retain them inside the bank insurance fund because he can't sell them. So that's what's going on with urban real estate. Outside in other communities, it's varied. But don't think that this is just a blue state problem. It's not. If you go to Cincinnati or Dallas or any of these other big cities in the southern part of the country where you have a lot of growth and a lot of new construction of homes and buildings and everything else, those cities are empty too. So we have to, as Americans, I think, reimagine and redevelop a lot of our cities. We've got to come up with a new use case for these properties. These are valuable properties. You look at what they've done in Detroit. I think Detroit's a model for that. They've had a huge amount of support from a number of businesses that just decided they were going to fix the city. But that's the scale of the effort we need, Julia. I joke that we need another Robert Moses. And Robert's going to need financing from Washington because, you know, the development community, they know what to do with these properties, right? They'll figure that out. They'll work with the local politicians and come up with new uses for these buildings, residential, whatever, right? But you do need a commercial hub in a city. You got to have business activity to pay for it. And that's, I think, what people are going to be wrestling with in places like New York, because you can't turn New York into 100% residential. It doesn't work. You got to have a commercial component that's going to basically lift all of the infrastructure costs in the city. You know, my ancestors were sandhogs, Julia. We were, you know, working under the river and they worked on the railroad too. But if you think about what it would cost to rebuild that infrastructure today, that you see in New York. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Labor costs, everything else.
The 2,000 square foot was so crazy.
Yeah, to acquire and build. So you buy the property, you build it, all the costs of a construction project in New York City. And, you know, renovation is also very expensive in New York. You got to start putting up scaffolds. You might as well be building a building, right? And that's what I think is so challenging, is to find a way to, you know, reimagine some of these properties, restructure them. You may have to take the buildings down and start again. So that's what I think we're facing on the commercial side. It's a long-term problem. It's like Texas in the 1970s after the oil bust is kind of what we're dealing with, except in cities.
So going back to this notion of we're seeing this bifurcation from the consumer and the commercial side, when you kind of look at the economic picture, is it a healthy economy? How do you kind of contextualize it? Remember, like, I mean, a lot of folks last year thought we were headed to recession. That seems to not be the base case anymore. How do you kind of like diagnose it?
I think it's an economy that is still producing nominal growth, but where people are struggling because of costs. You talk to anybody in the home building industry, for example, their big issue is cost. So what are they doing? They're taking cost out of homes, pushing the price down, but they're also pushing down what they're putting into the property in terms of quality. So I think there's a qualitative recession going on here, Julia, in terms of, you know, how much is in the box of cereal, if you will. But at the same time, you know, the aggregate numbers look fine. Default rates for consumers are still reasonably low. They're barely up to 2019 levels. So it's not a screaming recession. You know what I mean? This is not a headline typical kind of recession. And I think what we may be facing going forward is more of the same. In other words, you're not going to see big moves in interest rates. I think the Fed would like to avoid that if they can because of the cost. And then the rest of it is simply a case of, I think, partly demographics and partly some other factors. So we may be facing a fairly boring few years. You know, think about if you're a realtor, a lot of the business you did in 2020, 21, you normally would have had now, but you don't have those transactions now. They were pulled into the future or the present with low interest rates. So now that you have 7.5% mortgages, you really just have 100% purchase market. There's almost no refinance activity at all. And the industry is downsizing rather dramatically. So you think of housing. Housing's huge. And you could really say that the whole complex is kind of, you know, mediocre to down. We're shedding employment. We're not building as many houses. The banks are very cautious about lending on new construction. But at the same time, as we said before, the defaults are still very low. It's almost like you can't lose money on a 1-to-4 family home right now as a lender. Because think about it. The default rate on an apartment building or the net loss is 100%. So they're basically saying you're losing everything, right? The default rate on a 1-to-4 family home owned by a bank is zero. So in other words, if they actually foreclose, which is quite rare, they pay off the whole loan and then they have some money left over. That is not normal, by the way. The average loss rate on 1-to-4 family homes is like 60, 70%. It went up to 100% after the great financial crisis. But low rates has had this effect on, I think, the consumer side of the equation, Julia, where the numbers look okay. If you talk to people, they'll tell you they're working harder for less than they were 5 years ago, which is why Joe Biden is having such a difficult time, you know, talking about prices, talking about inflation in his campaign. Because people are hurting. There's no other way to put it. Everybody who could raise their prices coming out of COVID did. And I think for a lot of businesses, they felt like they were recouping something they had lost earlier, where they had to make price concessions to their customers. So, you know, that's kind of where we are. Go out to dinner in New York City and you'll see it. Oh, the plates are smaller.
Yeah, we do not go out to eat as much as we used to.
I think a lot of people are that way because it's so expensive. And yet, you know, when you walk around New York, you see lots of tourists and lots of people out in the restaurants, which is good. But that tourist crowd is not in New York City spending the kind of money you need to pay for it. They have a totally different use case and price point. A lot of my relatives from Latin America come up here all the time with their big families. And basically they just wander around. It's not like they're not going to go out to Jean Georges and drop $400 a piece on dinner, right? No, definitely not.
Yeah, definitely noticeable. I actually buy all my stuff pretty much direct now from farmers here in North Carolina, which has been a blessing to have.
But think about the cost differential between where you are, Julia, and anywhere around New York City.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably a third.
Yeah, it is. Let me ask you this, because it's an election year. How does, I'm not trying to get into politics or anything, but how does that kind of factor into like maybe more of the picture of the economy and markets? Does that factor in? Is that a big component? How do you think about it?
The markets are largely indifferent to the election. I don't know that they know what to think. I think most people on the street would be happy to have more Biden. They want the Republicans to control at least one house of the Congress. The Biden administration, who I deal with quite a lot on the financial side, has been a mixed bag. They really have not had good people in key positions. And what happened was they put a lot of kind of decorative people into cabinet positions, and then they have a whole group of people inside the White House who actually run policy. It's kind of a horizontal approach to policy. So I would love to have a change. I don't really care for either candidate, Trump or Biden. I think Biden is worse for growth because of some of the policies that these folks come up with. I don't know where they come from. They don't make a lot of sense, especially in the housing and banking side, this whole Basel rule, which I think is fascinating, Julia. If they had brought that rule to a vote at the Federal Reserve Board, it probably would have been voted down. Think about that. I think there were at least 3 to 4 no votes among governors, including Chairman Powell, by the way. So ponder the politics of that. I think there's a big disconnect in Washington, and I think Americans are so frustrated with what they're dealing with from government generally, that they would love to have a change. I just think we've got to wait for a few people to die before that's going to happen. Sad to say.
Yeah. I want to give you the final few minutes here to share some parting thoughts, maybe something that we didn't bring up in this episode or anything that you'd like to go back to and revisit.
Well, I think we're coming into an interesting period where real investments that actually have returns are going to come back into vogue. That may sound extraordinary and unlikely, but I do really believe that the change in the amount of excess savings that are available in the major industrial countries basically means we're going to have higher interest rates. And when you see higher yields on bonds and also stocks, that's going to start to, I think, affect investor behavior and also allocation behavior. Those pension funds that were willing to put 20% of their nut into private equity are now very chastened because they don't have liquidity for those investments. So I think people are going to put a preference and a real premium on liquidity, Julia. They're going to want value too. As I've been working on my bank ETFs, I've been amazed at how many people have asked me to do an income strategy. Think about that. Now, if you do an income strategy with, say, bank stocks, preferreds, bonds, would you use leverage? No. The leverage doesn't help anymore because it's too expensive. So we're moving out of a period where leverage was too cheap, and it kind of, I think, fueled some bad decisions on the investment side. Look at the ARC funds. Who would have thought of that? Everybody thought Cathy walked on water a year ago, right? And look at how fast things have changed. So I think whether you follow NVIDIA, which I'm out of, by the way, I got out well above 700, but what a crazy ride that was, huh? And I just don't know if we're going to see investment narratives like that in the future. I think it's going to be a little more boring. So, income is going to be sought after by a lot of investors. And I think they're going to be surprised at how high some of the yields can be, even without leverage.
Do you think, is that probably a good thing though? Like the death of leverage, could that be a good thing?
I do. Yeah. Money is not free. There's a reason it says 6% in the Bible. And what I think the Fed learned was that once we get down below 6%, the bang for the buck of dropping rates further declines. There's a diminishing return. So there's also a lot of negative impact of the, you know, volatility we've seen in interest rates. So I think if we could wish for a future, it would be one with less rate volatility, higher income. The banks certainly need it over time. It'll help them heal. And I think the whole financial system would be healthier if we put a little bit more weight on income and a little bit less on speculative, aspirational pricing, you know? Because that's what happened in commercial. At the end of COVID, people jumped into commercial real estates, Julia. The pricing moved up dramatically. And now we're sitting here with a bubble and it's going back the other way. And normally, you don't expect that kind of volatility in commercial properties, right? But that's what happened. There was a kind of a crazy, irrational component, I think, largely because of the pandemic. People were scared in the same way they were scared in 2008. Right. So if you think of 2008 forward to today, we've had 15 years of volatility, life support by the Fed, all the rest of it. Right. Now we have to see if we can get back to a boring normal, you know, work on metabolism as opposed to replication, I guess, is the way Freeman Dyson would put it. Right. But, you know, that I'm not pessimistic at all. I just think there's a lot of change going on right now.
Yeah,
in the financial markets.
Well, one more before I let you go. Is there a level of rates that seems to make the most sense for you that's like, that would kind of be more of an, maybe it's a new normal or a normal? How would you describe
Well, look, the Fed, because of the way they moved interest rates up and down, has done great violence to the term structure of rates. In other words, if you look at all securities and you say, what's the average coupon? So, you know, for dealers today, if I'm trying to make markets in existing paper, I really need to have Fed funds down, you know, 4.5. So a point below where we are. That way, at least I'm making money on my inventory. I'm not taking a loss every day on paper that I own. Same thing for lenders. If I have a 6.5 or 7 or 7.5% mortgage and I'm paying 7.5 for short-term warehouse before I issue the securities, I'm losing money, Julia. So the short-term rates are clearly a pain point. Long-term, I'm not so sure that it matters as much. I think we can function just fine where long-term rates are today, but I think they may go higher. So I expect in a year or so, we're going to see short-term rates lower and a normal yield curve that we haven't seen in decades. Can you imagine that? We could have a party. We'll have a yield curve party. But that's not a bad thing. You know, if long-term investors could actually buy bonds and not have to worry about the volatility, that might not be a bad thing.
Certainly. Well, Chris, I have to say it has been an absolute pleasure having you on. I love having you on. I love listening to you. I love learning from you. You're definitely a friend of the show. So Chris Whalen.
Let's do it more. Hey, Janet Alvarez does me once a month now on Sirius. It's really great.
Oh, okay. Maybe we might have to up our frequency. But Chris Whalen, Chairman of Whalen Global Advisors, author of Institutional Risk Analyst. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, your ideas, all of your wisdom and knowledge. I really appreciate you, Chris.
Hey, likewise, Julia. Have a great day.